Well, we return to the Song of Solomon to consider again the love and loveliness of Christ. And not only that as an observer, but for the believer as the thing that we're living upon. Tonight we want to look at a passage that helps us to avoid a danger which attends all talking and thinking about the interiority of the Christian life. When we deal with the subjective elements of Christianity and the experiences of the Christian life, it's easy to get off track on things that look like they're helpful, and they look like they're biblical. And there is enough help and there's enough biblical truth in them to tempt us. But if we get on this track, it may look like it runs right down alongside maybe a better, more careful path. But eventually it will lead to something that's not honoring to the Lord. The present cure for evangelicalism's mad pursuit of experiences is to return to the high church approach. I don't know if you have noticed this, but when I was in college, I mean, I knew almost no one except for Roman Catholics who did kind of the high church approach. And I lived in Ohio, so all my family is Roman Catholic except for my parents. We were the Baptists. We were the only oddballs in the group, you know, so we'd have family get togethers on Sunday. So we'd go to church. Everybody else got out earlier than the Baptists. So we'd show up late and the good stuff was already eaten. Then it was time for night church. And my Roman Catholic aunts and uncles could not understand why my parents were so being so stubborn as to go back to church again on Sunday. But off we went. And I always wondered what people did on Sunday evenings who got to stay home. I do remember Wonderful World of Walt Disney and Tinkerbell coming out and it'd be some Disney movie on and my parents say, "All right, get in the car, it's time for church." And I think, "Oh, those kids don't have to go, you know." Glad my parents took me. When we think about the experiential aspects of Christianity, there are a great many dangers. Right? There really are dangers, but the dangers do not require us to take the option that we approach Christianity as if there is no experience. John Wesley, when he was looking at the evangelical revivals, what they call the 18th century revivals there, he was looking at the work of God in the 18th century there and the extraordinary outpouring of God's kindness on the land. And after a few years, he started noticing a certain coolness creeping into those that once were warm in their love for Christ. And so he would often write books and have conferences where he would rebuke his own preachers or rebuke everybody. But John Wesley warned his listeners about the danger of religious enthusiasm. Right? Now, we don't use the word enthusiasm the way they used to. In the 18th century, an enthusiast was not a person that was really excited about something. It was a person who was a fanatic and in an unhealthy way. So Wesley said, if we could translate it into modern language, a religious fanaticism. And this is what he said. A religious fanatic is a person who desires the end goal, but will not make the choices to do the steps that lie between here and where I want to be. So they want to be very godly. They want to be effective evangelists at the workplace. They want to grow in holiness, but they don't want to do the basic things the scripture says must be done to move in that direction. So he says, you're a religious fanatic. When we talk about the interior aspects of Christianity, there's always the danger of what we would call sentimentalism. That is, substituting the feelings that are aroused in the soul when we talk about these topics, substituting that for a real walking with the Lord. So we cannot help but feel, if we're not careful, that having my heart stirred during a service or during quiet time was the end that God was aiming at, rather than having a life that's transformed. So I have these extraordinary times of feeling. I enjoy what we're talking about. I appreciate the themes, but I don't change. You're a religious fanatic. We're sentimentalists if we're not careful. Think of love for Christ as a stream, all right? And that stream can be as deep, as wide, as powerful, all right? There's no limit on the degree of the stream. We might think that the way to guard against fanaticism is to keep the stream in, you know, small and don't love Jesus too much. Don't become a fanatic. But that's no help at all for the real believer. If the stream jumps the banks, though, and the banks being biblical patterns of how to live out my love to Jesus, then it may feel for a while that you really do love Christ. You're just kind of going down your own path. But I think what you'll find is that that stream will then meander into kind of a swamp, a marsh, and it will breed all kinds of ugly versions of Christianity. Or think about a postcard. Imagine a person that stays at home and you visit them and they never go anywhere. You know, they go to work, they come home, they watch television, they go to bed. They repeat that every day of their life. And you see that they've got all these photo albums. You open up, there's all these beautiful postcards, and you say to them, "Wow, those are great. When did you go there?" And they say, "Oh no, I don't go anywhere. I just have these beautiful postcards." It's easy to read portions of scripture, and particularly Christian biography, and you can appreciate that where they journeyed with the Lord, and you forget that you were given that to entice you to journey there, not as a substitute. So we want to be careful. What we're talking about this week, we don't want that to become a substitute for obedience. But it's not enough to want to walk with the Lord. There are some requirements. One of the requirements that the scripture makes very clear comes in the book of Amos. You know the verse? "Can two walk together unless they are agreed?" Amos 3:3. Is it possible to walk with God without being in agreement with God? It is impossible. Unless you think, of course, that two people can walk together headed in opposite directions. I mean, it just doesn't work, does it? We leave the doors. One of us heads to the East Coast. One of us heads to the West Coast. We're not going to travel together for very long. And in a situation where we're talking about us and God, you do understand that there's just no way that God is going to decide to walk on the path that we want to walk. And he's going to agree with us today. But that we, as the subjects, are going to have to bring our hearts in line with his. So there is no real walking with God unless we decide that we will agree with whatever he says is true. There is one infallible proof that a person is enjoying the nearness of God, and that is holiness. A progression in obedience. Do you remember Paul's words that we read last night? Colossians 2, "As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him." Think of this Christian life as a journey. This is what we see in Song of Solomon 8, 5, 6, and 7 there. The Christian life is a journey. It's not a nap. Samuel Rutherford warned his church members, "You will not be given permission by God to go to heaven in your pajamas," but they called them bedclothes back then. Do you intend to go to heaven in your pajamas? A good book? A cup of Starbucks? Next thing you know, you're in heaven. The Christian life is a journey. We get up, we walk. It's not a nap. The Christian life is not a sprint. It's a long journey. Conversion is not the end of the journey, is it? I come, God brings me under conviction. He strips things away that I thought gave me value. He removes all my crutches. When I finally feel that there's no reason for God to love a person like me, that there's no reason that I might be allowed to know peace with him, then he shows me the cross, and it's too good to be true almost, and I embrace it. But that's just the beginning. It's the gate being opened, and now there's a path. The Christian life is not a treadmill. Now, I think this is I don't know if this will be a good illustration for you, but I think this is very dangerous. We have many people who attend churches that are maybe more serious than other churches. So if you come here, I don't suppose you're coming here for the great choir music or for the pizza parties, you know, or for the games afterwards. You're coming here because you do intend to be somewhere where the pastor's going to be pretty serious and the teaching's going to be pretty serious. Be careful that you don't want a serious church like a fitness nut wants his treadmill. You cannot use Jesus Christ and good doctrine and good church and good friends to make yourself a person of excellence, a person that can look in the mirror spiritually and be proud of their progress. You're not here on planet Earth to use Jesus to make you a spiritually fit person. There's a destination. It's not a treadmill. It's a journey. Now, on this journey, we have a great pattern: looking unto Jesus. He's the pattern. But really, it's better than that, isn't it? We can have Jesus as the companion. Paul says that Christ is our sanctification. Now, what we want to talk about tonight is how is that to be the case in practical terms. And tonight's talk is one part of a two-part talk, right? So tonight we look at how is it that the Song of Solomon helps me understand the pattern for walking with Christ in such a way to promote holiness. Tomorrow night we look at the consequences if a Christian or a church decides that that's not essential. Well, Song of Solomon chapter 8, verse 5. What's the scene? Anthony just read this. The scene is a wilderness scene. And in the wilderness, the queen is coming up out of the wilderness, headed back toward civilization. Her back is to the wilderness. Her face is pointed away. She's coming up, but she's not alone. She's leaning on her love, the husband. She's tired. She leans on him. And he turns and he says something to her. And she turns and she asks something from him. And it's a wonderful scene for us to consider the whole theme of sanctification and how Christ is our sanctifier. All right, so let's kind of take these elements apart quickly and apply them to ourselves. We have in this scene the world, and the Bible describes it as a wilderness. Now, it is hard for us to see the world for what it is because there's a lot of false advertising. I mean, everywhere you look, it's false advertising. The world does not tell the truth about itself. Now, when we talk about the world, we're not talking about geographic, right? And we're not saying that if we lived in a little Christian commune, we'd be better Christians. That would really be a very sad choice. We're not talking about leaving the world. We're talking about the culture around us that thinks and chooses based on self instead of based on Christ. Or you could also see this as a picture of created things, not necessarily bad things, but any created thing that you think will make you happy. The bride is in the wilderness. She's coming up out of the wilderness. Her back is to the wilderness. Now, it is a wilderness. I know that we agree that some aspects of the non-Christian world are like a wilderness. For instance, if you come from a home where you are the only believer, and when you go home at night, if your family's not too gentle with this issue and they give you a hard time and they ask you, do you still go down to that cult group, or they ask you all these other questions that they're really giving you a hard time to go, you may look at that situation and say it's a wilderness. If you work in a very ungodly environment, you may say, yes, the world is a wilderness. If you go to college or university and you feel like you're surrounded by agnostics and atheists, if you go to a pagan place, a wicked city. One time I visited New Orleans when I was in college to do some street preaching. Completely ill-equipped for that. And I was an unconverted preacher, so that didn't help, you know. But there I was with the microphone hollering at people about Jesus that I had never met, but I was saying the right words. While I was down there, I decided to visit Bourbon Street, and I walked into a voodoo shop. I thought it was a joke. It was a real voodoo shop. It was quite apparent. I mean, it was, you could feel it. I don't say that about much things, but you could feel it. It was a wicked place. Yes, the world's a wilderness, but I live in Mississippi, and we're surrounded by nice churches and nice people that say, hey, y'all, and come on in. And when you leave, they say, oh, don't leave yet, which a guy from Ohio believes people that lie like that. And I tell my wife, they don't want us to leave. And she goes, that's what you say. They do want us to leave. It's 10:30. Come on, you know. And I'm going, no, they say stay. And took me a long time, hurt my feelings. All those people telling me not to leave, and they really wanted me to leave. And I live in a nice place. It's hard to think that North Mississippi is a wilderness. It is. There is, what is it about it that's a wilderness? Well, first of all, it's empty. It's barren. It's dry. The world, even the nice things in life, friendships, activities, possessions that God gives us, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you hope that that will satisfy you, it will leave you empty. The world is empty apart from God. The world is a wilderness. It's dangerous. It's not the kind of place you find rest for your soul. It's a place you travel through, but you don't build your house there. Samuel Rutherford, in prison, wrote a number of letters. A woman named Anne Cousin took those letters and took phrases from the letters and put them together in a very long hymn. I think there's 12 verses in the original. The hymnal that we sing from in North Mississippi has about 6 of them. But here's one of the verses he says. He's talking about the Christian's relationship to the world. Listen to what he says. He says, "Oh, well, it is forever. Oh, well, forevermore. My nest hung in no forest of all that death-doomed shore. Yea, let the vain world vanish as from the ship the strand. For glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land." So the picture is this. The Christian's on the ship. And the land, which is death-doomed, is slowly disappearing as the ship travels. And Rutherford said, "I'm not the guy leaning over the edge thinking, I wish I was still back there. No, no, I'm glad that that's not where my nest is hung. David said it this way in Psalm 63. "O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water." Now, there are many people in churches, and maybe you're one of them, who do not believe that the world is a wilderness. I mean, because you're surrounded by nice people and you have pleasant activities. Paul talked about people in the church at Philippi. He talks to the people about those who are in churches and they don't believe that the world is a wilderness. Listen to what he says in Philippians 3, verse 18. "For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now I tell you, even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ." It's quite a statement to make. I'm telling you about people in church. It breaks my heart to tell you, I've wept over these people. They're enemies of Christ's cross. That is, everything about their life or something in their life is opposed to what the cross is about. Then he describes them. Their end is destruction. Their God is their appetite. And their glory is in their shame. They set their minds on earthly things. John Owen in the 1600s wrote a little book called Spiritual Mindedness. And in the preface he says, "I wrote this book because it's just so easy for modern man to be worldly minded." That was in the 1600s. I know we can't imagine living in the 1600s and having anything to be attractive to us. But John Owen said it was easy to be worldly minded in the 1600s. This is what he wrote. "When the world fills our thoughts and the heart will soon be, then the heart will soon be entangled. And grace will be weakened. And the soul is in danger of eternal ruin." Now, if you don't believe that the world is a wilderness, one problem with that is you're going to have to believe that there is a wilderness. It's not the world. You believe God is a wilderness. Listen to what God says through Jeremiah in chapter 2. "Have I been a wilderness to you, Israel? Have I been a land of darkness? Why do my people say, 'We are lords and we will no more come to you'? I think the picture there is we're self-sufficient. We don't have to come to God. So God asked them that question. Have I been a barren, dry, perilous thing to you? Have you come to me and found me to be just a bunch of brambles and thorns? Why don't you come to me?" So let's just do a quick test before we move any further in our Song of Solomon. Which one is the wilderness to you? Don't give me the Sunday school answer. You know the Sunday school answers are the right answers, regardless of what you really believe. Now, I mean, if someone followed you around this week and they just made a list of the way you've lived over the last 7 days, which one would they say is the wilderness for you? So, for instance, questions like this. Which are you quick to run to? Which are you eager to get to? Time alone with God or the world? I mean, the world could be a lot of things, couldn't it? Entertainments, amusements, distractions. Could be really nasty things. Which one are you unwilling to leave? The Lord or the world? Which one are you reluctant to go to? Oh, I know I ought to. I guess I have to. The world or God? Which one are you quick to leave? The world or God? Are you the kind of Christian that finds themselves honestly reluctant to open the scripture in the morning? Something's cold within you. And you are eager to get through your chapter for the day to get on with more important things. Is God a wilderness? Has He been a land of darkness to you? Well, Song of Solomon says that the world is the wilderness. Now, look at the activity of the bride. She is leaving it. Her back is to it. Not like Lot's wife. She doesn't look back wishfully. She has her back toward it. Her heart is weaned. Now, how's your journey, Christian? Are you leaving the wilderness progressively? Are you, in your Christian life, could you say, as I look at myself now compared to a year ago or a month ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, are you less enticed with the world than you were? Are you more captivated by Christ's charms than you were then? Are you progressively walking away from the world's lies? Now, we do have to be careful when we say that, because when we ask ourselves this, we generally need to look at someone who knows us well, who's a Christian, and we can ask them, well, what do you think? Because we're not always good autobiographical judges. We look at our life and sometimes we despair when we shouldn't. Sometimes the Christian life is like this. It starts off on a mountaintop. I mean, I think that's most Christians' experience. You embrace Christ. You realize He's embraced you. The sin is washed away. There's a reason to wake up tomorrow morning. You're on the mountaintop, and it's like He takes you and says, look, you see in that distance and all through the mountains, but you're on the mountaintop. You see far, far, far away. Do you see that light on the horizon? Yes, that's where you're headed, like Bunyan's pilgrim. That's where you're headed. The goal is glory. The goal is complete transformation into My image. And you're going to be headed there every day of your life. You're going to be moving in that direction. So you start. Now, from the mountaintop, you look there, and it's a bit deceptive. You think, you know, I think with a couple months hard push, I can make it. I mean, who doesn't feel when they first become a Christian that in a few months, I'm sure I can make it through this book, and I'm going to be complete, completely Christ-like. I'm never going to sin again. God, just let me go. Hurry up. I'm ready. You go for a while along the ridge, and then you start to go down, you go up another mountain, go down. But maybe when you're down in the valleys as you're traveling, you stop. You begin to feel that you're a pretty poor excuse for a Christian. You try to get a good view of where you're headed again, and you can't even see it. It seems that it's further away than the day you first started. It's not. But your limited vision can't see it at that point. We're not always good judges of ourselves. So ask another person. Do you see me coming up out of the wilderness, or do you see me walking into the wilderness? Have I set up my tent here? It's a great description of a Christian, isn't it? Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? A Christian's not a particularly morally strong person. A Christian's not a person who has got it all together and whose willpower is so superior to the lost person's willpower. A Christian really is a person who's a great leaner. They have learned to depend upon someone else, upon the beloved. As your church goes through the attributes of God, you've got to grab those. And you've got to take them, and however you do it for yourself, you write it down on your notepad, you write it down on your iPad, I don't know what form you use, you stick it on a note card and stick it in your pocket, put it on your mirror so that every morning when you get up and brush your teeth, you see the attribute, you see a verse that goes along with it. Whatever you have to do to remind yourself, you're going to have to lean on the beloved to come up out of the wilderness. And it can't be a warm, fuzzy Jesus. You've got to have very clear views of who you're leaning on, because you're going to have to take every one of those attributes and say to God, God, the sin on my front porch that's waiting for me, the sin that's waiting at college, the sin that's waiting at work, the sin that's waiting when I walk around the corner and the kids are screaming, God, the temptation that's there, it's high definition, it's very crisp and clear. I need a clear view of Christ. And all of these attributes that I'm learning about, they were in Christ and they are for me. So I'm going to lean upon wisdom and power and omnipresence and eternality. And I'm going to lean upon purity and love and mercy and justice. I'm going to lean on all of you, not just who He is, but what He's done. God, you have made choices in eternity past. It's very hard to explain. Election? It's a great mystery. But you chose me before I was even created. The incarnation of Jesus Christ, the obedience of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, the intercession of Christ, and Christ ruling over all the worlds alone right now. Every one of these aspects of His work are given to mold me into His image. So I'm going to lean on all of those. But you have to be very intentional, don't you? It doesn't happen easily. It's by faith. Now, I hope it's obvious to you, but I guess it bears repeating that you can't lean on anyone else. There are leaners that are unhelpful kind of leaners, and those are people who are always dependent upon other people, godly people around them. It is good to benefit from the body. We can't grow as believers in the way we ought to if we're isolated from the body. But no one in the church can really be the one you lean on. You cannot lean on your spouse. You cannot lean on a good Christian friend. You can't lean on your pastors. One reason is they're all leaners themselves. Every person you have ever admired as a believer, every person that you have depended upon is a person who is constantly depending upon Christ. You're going to have to directly lean upon Christ. There is only one person who has walked down the path that you're walking down this week. He's walked down, he's faced every temptation, he's been in every foggy, misty, confusing fork in the road. He's walked past every lie and every danger, every fear and every doubt, and he's done it without ever stumbling. It's Jesus of Nazareth. And he has also walked that same path with every one of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of believers that preceded us, and however many will come after us. He's the only one that you can afford to lean on. He has never lost one traveler. Not one. Now that's the activity of the bride coming up out of the wilderness, her back to the world, leaning on him. Now, the husband speaks to the bride. Listen to what he says. He reminds her in verse 5, beneath the apple tree or the citrus tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor with you and gave you birth. Now, it's not often that I would suggest this, but the translation here is probably not the best translation of the Hebrew. George Burroughs, that I mentioned as the commentator, was not just a pastor. He's also a doctor of divinity. He's not just a pastor with his doctorate degree, but he was also a professor of Hebrew. And he translates this like this. Beneath the citrus tree, I awakened your affection for me. Then he says, it's best to translate it like this. There your mother pledged you to me. She who bore you betrothed you to me. So in other words, what as she's leaning on the king, what he turns and says to her is this. This is important. Remember, as we come up out of this wilderness, remember when we first met. Remember when I awakened your heart to me. remember when you were betrothed to me. You know, when Paul speaks to the Philippians, he says, I don't look back. I press on. I forget the things that lie behind. And that is the right thing to do if you're tempted to use the past as a substitute for obeying today. But Paul himself constantly asked church folks to remember, you once were, but now you are. He has. God's past kindnesses that you've experienced are a great foundation for future and present hope. God, I remember the day that I cared nothing for you and you captured my heart. I remember when all the sin was wiped away. I remember when you spoke to my heart and you enticed me. I remember those early days of love. As God speaks to the Jews in Jeremiah's day, I remember the early days of our betrothal. We walked together. There was sweet love. What happened? Why did you depart from me? The king turns to his bride. As she's coming up, she's weary. She's leaning all her weight on him. And he turns to her and he says, what? You lousy wife. Why are you such a wimp? I thought you were doing P90X when I was gone. I thought you could handle this wilderness stuff. No. And Christ doesn't turn to the Christian and say, you disappointing Christian. You've been a Christian for 10 years. You ought to be running. Why do I have to still carry you along? No, he turns to the Christian, leaning upon his character, leaning upon his work. And he says, remember, it's hard work coming out of the wilderness, but remember, remember the day we first met. Remember when you were betrothed to me. Remember when your heart was awakened. It's a great help to the Christian. Paul says it this way. In Romans 8, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not with him also freely give us all things? So we can remember. We say, God, I remember the cross. I remember the first work when the Spirit dealt with my soul. I remember when you brought me to yourself. Now, God, you've done so much. What would you withhold now? He's given us his son. He's given us the Spirit. Do you think he's going to hold back the pocket change of daily grace? The husband speaks to the wife. Now the wife has a request. She leans on his arm and she asks him, basically, to assure her that this will be an enduring support, love and strength. Look at verse 6. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is severe as Sheol or the grave. It flashes. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. And if a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. Well, what's she saying? Let's take that apart. She turns to him and she says, I want you to assure me that the strong arm of love will always be there. Do you not feel, Christian, the need for that? You stumble along. I mean, there are footprints all along this path. And some of them are off on the slippery edge of a precipice and they nearly fall over. I mean, you can walk. You can read scripture. There it is. Right? There's Abraham doubting. Coming up with plan B because he doesn't think God can give him a son. There's David and Bathsheba. There's where David had a great fall. Right? There's Peter. There's the others. God, are you sure you still want me as a bride? Are you sure you're willing to offer me this arm? Are you tired of having me by now? So she asks for assurance. In the Old Testament, there's a wonderful picture of this. Put my name over your heart, she says, right? In other words, with this indelible ink, write me where? Over your affections. Assure me, tell me that you will never be able to look at me without love. That it will never wear off. Stamp it like a seal on your heart. In the Old Testament, the priest goes into the holy place and he wears all those special garments. And you remember one of the garments was an ephod and it goes over his robes. And then there's a breastplate over that, and it had what on the breastplate? Do you remember what it had? What was it? Yeah, jewels, 12 jewels, and each jewel the name of a tribe. So it's a picture that everything the priest does in there, everything that transacts between him and God, he's doing it with each tribe of Israel over his heart. It's for them that I'm here. But you know, a priest leaves the temple. I mean, he doesn't stay there his whole life. He leaves, he goes home. When he leaves, he takes off the ephod. He takes off the breastplate. He puts on his normal guy clothes. Jesus of Nazareth has our names written across his heart. He never takes them off. He is able to save us to the uttermost. How? He always makes intercession. Everything Christ does in heaven, it is with an affection for each of the believers in mind. Put my name on your heart. What about his arm? Put my name over your arm. That is, every time you exert your strength, let it be with me in mind. Do you remember what Paul says at the end of Ephesians chapter 1? I'm praying that God would open your eyes that you could see the reality of these things I've been explaining. In particular, the power of God that's at work in a believer. The same power that raised Jesus from the dead. The one that's now ascended and reigning beside the Father, ruling over all things for the good of the church. How in the world can Paul say everything works for good to those that are called, to those that love God? Because their name is written over his arm. The arm of the God-man rules the universe. It must be an amazing sight for angels to see one of Adam's race, one of us, on the throne beside the Father. The arm of a man is there, but the name of the believer is written across it. And he rules over all things for the good of his church. Now, is that what you would ask from Jesus? Or would you ask for things like, God, I'm having a real hard time in work and I pray that you give me a better, different job. Or I really need a boyfriend. Or I need this. Or I need to pay my bills. Or I need you to consider the health of my family. I mean, there's so many things we could ask. And it's not like you're only allowed to ask one thing. But if you could only ask one thing, would you say what she said? Would you turn to him and say, will you tell me that the strong love will never be pulled away from a person like me? Why is she so impressed that she asked for that? Look at her description of love, of his love. Love is, and then she gives a series of descriptions. It's as strong as death. How strong is death? Don't we all have people in our lives, if you've lived very long, you do. Someone that you knew that looked like they were in the best of health. And then they feel a little strange. They go to the doctor. They get the worst report. And within weeks, they have wasted away and they die. And we look at them when we haven't seen them for a few days. We visit them again and we try not to show it. God, they're so wasted. They're dying in front of our eyes. Death takes the proudest, strongest of humanity and brings it low. Death is strong. But friend, Christ's love is stronger than death. Death is jealous like the grave, cruelly jealous. Jealousy is cruel. The grave is jealous. What is that? It's just a poetic way of saying this. When you lay a loved one in the dirt, they don't come back to us, no matter how you wish they would. The grave is greedy and jealous. And if you want them back, it doesn't give them back. And love is as strong as that. There is only one voice anywhere that calls people out of the grip of the grave's jealousy. It's the voice of God. Lazarus, come forth. There is no voice that calls the believer out of the embrace of Christ. His love is jealous. Would you like to go back to the old life at times as a believer? Do you believe the lies? Do you grow cold? Do you think very quietly, shockingly, you think, sometimes I wish I could go back to the old habits? If you try, believer, you will find it a miserable life, because His love is as jealous and possessive as a grave. His love is also described as fire, burning, consuming, burning off all the stuff that gathers about our lives, the chaff, unquenchable. If you pour great waters on it, floods on it, it doesn't quench it. It doesn't go away. You try to quench it with the sins in your own heart, and it's not quenched. Where sin abounds, grace overabounds. When you're indifferent, He's not indifferent. You try to think that love would be quenched because of your circumstances. You look around you and you think, surely the love of God has been snuffed out, and it's not. His love is the kind of thing that if you tried to purchase it by selling everything you had, even the world, if it believed in this kind of love, would look at you and despise you for insulting the lover like that. How can you think that you could buy that kind of love? Now let's, in conclusion, just listen to a couple of believers that have run the path before us, leaning on the beloved, all right? Let's take Paul. He said this, "The love of Christ constrains me." You do have that right in your mind, correct? He doesn't say this, "I love Jesus so much, I feel constrained." Well, that's probably true in Paul's life, but he doesn't say, "My love for Jesus keeps me on track." He says this, "Christ's love for me holds me." The same word that was used for a horse with blinders. I stay on the straight path. Why don't you go here? Why don't you go here? Paul, why not just for a little bit? Why not take a little detour? The love of Christ, it's constraining me. His love for Paul could not be shaken. Paul could never go back to the old life and sin lightly again. Listen to another friend, John Bunyan. John Bunyan, when he wrote the book, The Pilgrim's Progress, he had Pilgrim, the Christian, after he came to the cross. So he's a brand new believer. He goes to visit Mr. Interpreter. Right? That makes sense, doesn't it? He's at Interpreter's house. So Mr. Interpreter basically is an older believer that takes the baby believer and says, "Before you set out on this journey, I've got some things the king wants me to show you about the Christian life." So he takes him to a number of rooms in the house, things that are important for a Christian to know. One of the rooms, there's a fireplace, and the fire is raging. But an enemy stands beside the fireplace and throws water on it, but it doesn't go out. And the man asks him, "Do you understand this?" "I don't know why it's not going out. Come with me." They walk around the back of the wall, and on the other side, behind the fireplace has two sides. On the back of the fireplace, there's Christ, a picture of Christ, throwing oil on the fire. What is Bunyan saying? You watch a Christian go through the hardest of times that you think, "God, will this snuff out the love?" You see a Christian sin against God in such a horrible way. Will this make you leave them behind? Will you dump them now? And it's quite a mystery to us. They're not left to themselves. They're not quenched. They're not snuffed out. Why? Because Christ is there, pouring oil on the fire. Let me give you another friend, a man named John Berridge. Now, you may not know John Berridge. He was a friend of George Whitefield and John Wesley. He was a pastor long before he was a Christian. But when he became a Christian pastor, he became a mighty force in the land. In fact, J.C. Ryle wrote a history of the 18th century, and he said that of men in the U.K., those who had been most singularly used for the conversion of souls, you have Whitefield and Wesley, but the next one was John Berridge. John Berridge wrote a book And he called it cheerful piety or cheerful holiness. That was the secret of his life. A happy holiness. And this is what he wrote. This is, I believe, on your list of quotes. If we desire to be holy, we must seek to be happy in the Father's love. There is no other way. You can't really be holy by loving cleanness and sterility. You can't really be holy by having a great willpower. You are holy. You are holy by this great attraction. I am happy in Him. I don't want that. Charles Simeon, a few years later, second generation of the revivals, friend of John Newton. Charles Simeon was a pastor of a church. They hated him. They locked the church door. I think it was for 13 years. I can't remember. John Piper did a really great biographical sketch of this man. He becomes the pastor of a church in Cambridge, England. I've been to this place. I saw his umbrella. If I weren't a Christian, I'd have snatched it and run. I don't know what I would do with a 200-year-old umbrella. Probably wouldn't work very well. Charles Simeon became the pastor of the church. The people hated him. Why? Because he taught that you must be born again and that the Anglican baptism wasn't enough. They knew he was one of those men that believed like Whitfield and the other revivalists. So they locked the doors every week. Doors locked. Everybody's waiting outside. You go get the warden. He's forced by law to open the door. You go in. The pews are locked. They had gates on the pews back then because the rich people rented them. So instead of attending church, they locked their pews and the people would have to just stand in the aisles. This went on year after year after year. But he was such a gentle and godly young man that he won them over. He became a professor at Cambridge University, spent his entire life as a single man training young ministers. And this is what he wrote. There is nothing under heaven that can constrain a Christian soul like the sense of redeeming love. How did you put up with people that locked the door for 13 years? The sense of redeeming love. Thomas Chalmers, my last example. Years later, 1820s. Thomas Chalmers is a Scottish fella. He was the leader of the moderates of the Church of Scotland. Now, you have to understand, in Scotland at this time, there's really only one big church. Everybody else is a very tiny sliver of society. So Baptist, very little. You know, Methodist, just a few. Everybody's a Presbyterian. Everybody's Church of Scotland. And in the Church of Scotland, about 9/10 of the Church of Scotland were what they called moderates, liberals, who did not believe you had to be born again in the way we believe. 1/10 was evangelical. Thomas Chalmers was a mathematician. Thomas Chalmers was a theologian. He was the head professor at the big seminary for the Church of Scotland. He was the head of the denomination. And when he was converted, he walked over from the liberal side to the evangelical side. He lost everything. He lost his job. He lost his position. He became the leader of 1/10 of the Church of Scotland. He became a professor at a tiny school compared to what he was at. And this is what happened. Thomas Chalmers never was used, as far as I know, never used by God as an extraordinary minister in the sense of great numbers of things. But he became the teacher of the men that were used in extraordinary revival. For instance, Andrew Benar and Robert Murray McShane. How did he give everything up without becoming bitter? How did he press on and spend the rest of his life training other men to be greatly used? This is what he said. He said, there is an expulsive power in the new affection. There is something in the new love that enters the heart when God saves us that expels everything else. Well, we've come to the end of our passage. Let me ask you, what would you leave behind? What phrase will you leave behind? When you're gone and the next generation comes and they don't even remember us, what will your life say? Will it say things like, if we desire to be holy, we've got to be happy in the Father's love? Will it say things like, there's nothing that constrains like the love of Christ? Or will it say things like, there is an expulsive power in this new love? What message will we leave behind for the generation that follows us as they have to come up out of the wilderness? leaning on the beloved. Well, let's pray.